It's really hilly, really hilly, and he's always
Can't miss him.
Up there and he's worried about.
Well, welcome everybody to the May 20th, I guess it is, meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. We have a number of information reports today. I think we'll start off and do our transportation. So start off with Craig. Mr. Campbell, welcome. So you're going to tell us where we are with the transportation forum and discussions about how we're going to finance this wonderful system in the future, right?
Indeed, I have all the answers.
You got all the answers. Yes. Jeez, there we go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here today as president of the Oregon Transportation Forum. I'll give you a very brief background on the forum. It once upon a time was the Oregon Highway Users Alliance, but we came to the recognition after the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act that the process that had been done there, which had brought everyone together, was a much better approach, and that it was no longer a discussion around the highway system, but the transportation system as a whole that needed to occur. So we reformed ourselves into an organization that has membership from the environmental community, the land use community, the business community, all modes of transportation, every level of government, except for that we don't have anyone from the federal government yet, but we'll work on that.
We don't need them.
Exactly. our vision is that we're a private nonprofit membership organization that encourages full development and maintenance of transportation modes for the safe and efficient movement of people and products, to encourage integration of highways and highway transportation with other modes, including pedestrian, bicycle, air, transit, marine, and rail. The forum provides members an opportunity to network with elected officials and with leaders in the transportation community. So that's kind of our official statement. What really that means is we provide a table that folks can come around, have a good discussion about where does the transportation system need to be moving, how are we going to take care of that system, and what are kind of the new cutting-edge ideas that we need to bring to the table for discussion, in the hopes that that then translates into a legislative discussion and a discussion in the executive branch around how to deal with transportation issues. We decided at the end of the last session that we were going to organize ourselves this time around specifically with an eye to providing a forum for discussions for a 2015 funding policy package, realizing that much energy was being put into the Columbia River crossing. In that discussion, there was concern that there was not going to be time or somebody who would be willing to put together that discussion until that was over, so we kind of got started as a placeholder. Since then, the governor has indicated a desire to do a process, and we've had good discussions with Carmen Fore about how to facilitate what we're doing with what they're doing. Our position was, if the governor wants to take the ball and run with it, we'll stand aside and let him do it. We're happy with that. But if there's any role we can play, we're happy to do that as well. And as a result of those discussions, we've focused our conversation around trying to come up with things that are critical for 2015, prioritize those items for 2015, and then come up with good plausible policy and fiscal reasons why 2015 is the time to do them and how to do them. Now, that being said, we broke up into four groups, subgroups, to talk about various aspects of the transportation system. Two of them deal with funding. Those are our fix-it and enhance committees. Fix-it, of course, dealing with the needs of maintaining the existing system. Again, all modes discussion, not just highway. And then the enhance, which is dealing with the modernization and expansion of the transportation system and how to integrate those systems together through infrastructure development. We also have a group that's looking at innovations. So innovations in taxing policy, innovations in, well, there's, I'll talk to you a little bit about some of the ideas that they're coming forward with. And then there's another group that's looking at the communication, education, and the lobbying side of this. And I'll say there, we're operating very much like we did back in 2008, where there's a critical role to be played, as we have a lot of new legislators who will be coming into the session next time around. Those folks may or may not have a background in transportation, and even for those who have been in transportation for years, it's always good to have a refresher and maybe hear about things that are coming down the pike. So I'll talk a little bit more specifically about what proposals are currently being discussed, but I want to put a caveat. The Oregon Transportation Forum has a very restrictive means by which we as an organization can support a particular proposal. It has to pass the majority of members, and then it has to have a unanimous approval by the Board of Directors before, as an organization, we can support something. So with that in mind, these are the ideas that are being discussed, but they have not been adopted by anyone as of yet. Enhance group is talking about two major proposals. One is a 5-cent gas tax that would be split into a rather non-traditional 50-50 split. We have the 50 for state, 30-20 for local governments. What they're talking about doing is actually having a 50-50 split where all of it is used for essentially enhanced type projects. And this is highway only, because these are dollars that, of course, would be constitutionally restricted for highway use. But the idea would be that these sort of things would be more of a grant type of program and would include discussions at the local level by cities and counties, which usually use their portion for maintenance and preservation type activities. So this kind of attempts to set aside a bundle of money that would be used by the locals for true enhancement sort of projects. They're also talking about the idea of dedicating a certain portion of the lottery. One of our biggest challenges is finding a dedicated funding source for non-highway modes. Yeah. Some of you were involved in the discussion that happened, I think it was about 3 years ago, where the governor brought together a large group. And Senator Beyer, did you chair that? I'm trying to remember who chaired that particular group. But essentially, 60 ideas were put up on the board.
Oh, yeah,
and really, none of them were the ones that said, you know, people said, aha. So the one that came out of that we're looking at, of course, is trying to dedicate a portion of the lottery fund. There's challenges to that. There are other people who use those funds and aren't particularly keen on the idea of us using those funds. So that discussion will be ongoing. But that would be split into two different sources. Half of it would be used for the traditional Connect Oregon, which is designed to provide grant and loan funds for the purposes of expanding infrastructure for freight movement. The other side would be used for people movement, non-highway people movement, so transit, bike, ped, but would also allow some of that money to be used for operational costs of transit, which is another challenge we have. There really isn't an existing capability of providing an ongoing state-level funding source for operating transit. The next group that we have that's been meeting is the one that is dealing with, well, it's they're dealing with the innovation, efficiency, and policy ideas. They have a slew of rather interesting issues that they've brought up. One of them you've heard before, and that's indexing. But the discussion is a little different than it has been in the past, because indexing has traditionally been tied to some sort of an inflationary factor to prevent the legislature from having to come back every few years and readjust the gas tax to keep up with inflation. That's the traditional indexing, and that's certainly on the table for discussion purposes. The other issue that's been brought up is indexing to fuel efficiency of vehicles. Now, during the last session, we had discussion about the creation of a VMT pilot project. Mm-hmm. That pilot project is not fully underway, and so as a result, we don't know how well it will work in the real world, and we're hoping to see how that pans out so that we can solve the long-term deterioration of our funding through the gas tax because of fuel efficiency. As a kind of a stopgap measure, if you create a means by which you can index to fuel efficiency, what you do is you prevent that loss at least from those who are currently paying the gas tax. It still doesn't deal with non-payers to the highway system that use the highways. And so that's where the VMT discussion comes in later on. We're, of course, watching what's happening with the road user charge. I don't know if there will be any proposals coming forward on that yet. There may be some discussion about expanding the pilot program if that's something that can be done. So that may be a recommendation you see as well. We're continuing the discussion around the efficient fee approach. And basically what that means is if you're going to spend money, in the transportation system, you're going to try and capture that, or should you just be talking about the costs that are imposed upon the transportation system, or do you talk about other side costs as well, like the impact on the environment, the impact on the economy for things like accidents, noise pollution? So there's a lot of things that are happening. Most of that is happening in the cost allocation study review team process, but our group is looking at that as well, as they are watching with great interest as to what the results of the study, entire study is going to be, to find out if there will be a recommendation that comes there. Obviously, that's one that has a great deal of controversy between those who live in eastern Oregon, particularly in the mountainous regions, and those who live in the valley. We're going to be coming forward. I'm almost certain there will be a proposal to talk about the need for a large-scale strategic needs analysis. What we have is we have a transportation system where there's a lot of information in a lot of different places, but it hasn't been conglomerated into a way that it really tells us where we need to go with our long-term spending in transportation. And so getting your arms around that has been quite a challenge, and the reason is it's not in one place. So one of the things we'll be asking for very likely is some sort of funding for a strategic plan and a needs analysis to be done starting in 2015. Coordinating transportation with human services transportation in particular. We've had a lot of discussions around elderly and disabled, but we also have a large network of movement of folks in the human services system. To the extent that we can benefit each other by working together, that's something that we're going to be exploring as well. Creating a people moving plan that is similar to the freight plan. The freight plan is a kind of all modes plan for how we move freight in the state. We don't do that yet with people moving. We have separate plans. We have a bike ped plan, we have a rail plan, we have a transit plan, but we don't have a people moving plan. And to facilitate intermodal connections, it's much easier to do that if you start talking with all hubs about all hubs at the same time or all modes at the same time. With that is a concept about intermodal hubbing, where you have moderate to large cities, you try and co-locate as many different modes as possible so that it's easier for those who want to make choices from moving one type of mode to another. You make that as easy as possible. Makes the use of the system much more efficient. There's an ongoing discussion, as there was in 2008, about the idea of co-locating facilities that are used by different layers of government, city, county, and state. If you have facilities that are dealing with transportation, repair, maintenance, having those in one roof is less expensive than having them under three roofs. So we'll be having a discussion about that. Continue to have the discussion that came out of the Jobs and Transportation Act about trying to come up with tools that local governments can use around reducing greenhouse gas, and that's the scenario planning to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that's been led predominantly by Metro, which also happens to be the one MPO that has the infrastructure and the capacity for doing that. So it's not an idea about forcing others to do it. It's coming up with the tools that if they're capable of doing, they'll be able to take on. There will be a challenge there that if other MPOs are asked to do that, there will have to be money that goes along with it because they just don't have the financial capability of doing those without some assistance. We're watching a couple of issues that are outside the traditional norm for us, the carbon tax and where that goes, because that could be a side-by-side or an alternative to the VMT tax. And then autonomous vehicles, which we may chortle a bit now about the idea of cars moving without human drivers. However, the testing in that area is fairly robust, and if we're not ahead of it, we'll be behind it. So the idea there is to keep an open mind and see where we can provide and facilitate integration if such an integration is going to occur. With that, that covers the major proposals that we've got coming forward. We still have work that's going to be, we're going to be working with Willamette University to do what we did back in 2008, and that's to create an educational opportunity for new legislators and existing legislators that is a lobby-free environment so that you can get information about how the transportation system is funded, how taxes are done, how roads are built, how rail is run, the works. And you can ask any embarrassing question you want. although us lobbyists wish we could be there because we'd like to have those questions answered too, because we have a lot of those really embarrassing simple questions too. But we're going to leave you to your own devices with people who know what they're talking about. And with that, if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Greg. We appreciate the work that the forum's doing. Questions, Senator Monroe?
Craig, thanks a lot. I appreciate your work, appreciate the work of your group. You've touched on, there are so many transportation-related issues that are unresolved that we need to keep working on, and collectively and or one at a time or whatever works. Your earlier comment, you talked about the governor and how you're willing to work with him or not, whichever way it seems to work. Well, I happen to know that this governor very strongly wants to work with labor and business in any ongoing project for funding of whatever. And so I think he'll be involved with you in whatever the plans are. How are we going to resolve the issue of the declining revenue source from gas taxes? How are we going to resolve the issue of fuel efficient or non-fuel, electric type cars and how they pay their fair share? How are we going to resolve the issue of elderly and handicapped transportation and the fact they rely on 2 cents of the cigarette tax, which is a declining, really declining revenue source, and thankfully. And how are we going to deal with that when, in fact, the need keeps increasing as more and more of us get to that age where we may need, those kind of services? Just issue after issue after issue, and you touched on them, and I'm looking forward to working with you in the 2015 session, and hopefully we can get some resolution to at least a portion of these problems, or at least get moving in the right direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, thank you for that. And I do have to, again, make sort of a caveat. We don't yet know what the temperature is in the legislature for what all you're going to want to see. I laid out a huge span of issues, any one of which could take up a lot of work.
Yeah.
So it's not likely that you're going to see all of these things coming forward. And we also have a realization that the transportation system discussion is not one that you deal with in one session, although historically the way we've dealt with transportation funding is you have a large package and then you wait a long time, then you have another large package. So we're hoping that we might curtail that approach and have more of a every session we have some touch on transportation going forward. But we have yet to kind of test the pulse of you, the legislature, as to what you're going to want to hear from us. But our hope was not to stifle discussion so that in case you get that rare gem that pops out from the non-traditional voice that gives you that aha moment, we want to make sure that the table's set for that to occur.
Well, please let me know how I can help. Looks like the voters are going to send me back here again for one more term anyway.
My condolences.
And so I'm looking forward to working with you.
Thank you. Senator Girard?
Thank you. Craig, I liked a lot of what you said, but there's one thing that gave me a little heartburn, and that was the distribution of the money that currently is 50-50, 30 to the counties, 20 to the cities, but you wanted to go to a grant sort of formula. That bothers me only in the sense that rural Oregon really could use a lot of improvements, and I just, if it goes to grants, grant writing for a lot of those counties and stuff is a lot more difficult than, say, it is for Multnomah. So that is about the only thing that I think hit a hot button issue with me, is that I would like it just to stay, if whatever you do, to at least bring the counties and the cities into the discussion. And the grant thing would be a kind of a hard step for me, I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, that's a kind of an ongoing discussion. There's a, and let me give you what the balanced discussion is here. One, we're also talking about the idea of increasing the small cities allotment because
that's
the amount
right.
of money that goes to small cities is not really enough for them to do anything with. So where the trade-off here is, and we don't know if this is the direction they're going to go, is that if you get X amount of money and you're a city and it's not enough to do anything, you may have better luck if it is part part of a group of cities that's working together to for a project that works for all of them. Grant may not be the right way to put this. It's an allotment that would still go to cities and counties, but it would go there in such a way that they would spend it on project basis rather than an individual city just using it for their own purposes. How that dynamic is going to work, I don't know. But you're right. What we don't want to do is we don't want to stifle small communities that desperately need the funds in exchange for giving the money to folks who already not necessarily have enough, but at least are getting sufficient funds to do some major projects.
Yeah, I'm good.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, you mentioned strategic planning and needs analysis and bringing all that information together, and there's a lot of information out there in different places. What type of places are you meaning that this information exists? I thought that's what... I guess I just assumed that we had all that information together at the commission level, and that the Transportation Commission is considering all this... these various pieces of information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, when I mean multiple places, you've got transit districts that are independent from the state, you've got city and local governments. They have the information. They're not always available to the Transportation Commission, as an example. And this strategic plan, it wouldn't be for the Transportation Forum. It would be for you, for the Transportation Commission, those who are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis with how do you get your arms around the whole thing. They may get bits and pieces, and they can always reach out and get the information if they know to reach for it. But the state has its own projects, its own funding, but there are a lot of other, especially now that we're talking about multiple modes. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the state even has a particular role in, for instance, transit project funding, because those are all local entities. So it's trying to get the big picture so that those who have to make the big decisions have the information available. But that's really what we're talking about.
I would comment on that last point, though. The transit agencies may all be local, but they're all state agencies.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that correction.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, just while you're up here, do you know the numbers on the mileage project that we approved last session? We were like 5,000 people could be involved. Do you know the numbers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, it's 5,000, and it's broken down by fuel efficiency of the vehicle, I think. There are three different classifications. There are those that are above a certain mile per gallon, those that are below a certain mile per gallon, those that are in between the two. I can't tell you off the top of my head what those distributions are, but it's a total of 5,000 members, and it's volunteer.
And so have they gotten that many people to...
Mr. Chair, yet? Senator Thompson, I don't think the project has started yet. They're still kind of putting the pieces together before launch. Although there's a road user fee task force meeting
Tomorrow.
So you're welcome to come in and listen to the discussion there.
Okay. Great. Jim Witte and ODOT is sort of the knowledgeable person on that. Craig, thank you very much, and thank you for the group. I have to tell you, I've attended at least two, and I don't know if more, of the large groups and a couple of the smaller ones, and... if you can get all that group to agree in majority on anything, you know, it should be as happy for us. I mean, that is you almost have to rent the Rose Garden or the Moda Center now in order to get them all together. So it's a big group and represents a lot of good thought and good discussions. I was impressed with that. Senator Starr has attended some. I don't think anybody else on the committee has. The House has got... Have you been on to... The House has got some more active members than the Senate has had on it.
Mr. Chair, we very much appreciate your involvement, Senator Starr's involvement. And we have others who, although they're not attending, they're keeping in touch with us about how things are going. It's been very helpful to have you there.
I think the major issue on the funding is one that we have a system that was originally designed as a user pay system. So as you use it, you pay for it. Unfortunately, the users haven't been willing to pay, or at least the legislature hasn't been willing to allow them to pay their share of maintaining the system. Recent years, getting it. So if we can get away from somehow having to deal with it in the legislature on an ongoing basis, that would be a good thing. Some way to pay for that. And the transit system, I hear a lot about in my community and others. It's an issue. And a lot of folks in rural areas don't realize that y'all have them too. It's primarily dedicated to the senior and disabled services and significant issues and with the wonderful change we made in the energy efficiency program a couple of years ago, we kind of cut the heart out of that piece. Because it was more logical, the decision was made that we should do a direct appropriation rather than using a tax credit. Of course, we haven't made a direct appropriation, but it was a good idea. Anything else? Thank you, Craig. I appreciate it. Good luck to it all. We look forward to your work in 2015. I think we'll move to the other transportation issue, the routine update. Paul? Welcome, as always. Little note in my area is south that you're an unusual thing. You're apologizing for doing work on the freeway and delaying people.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Minister. Yes, we had some difficulty Sunday night with a project. We're just getting started down there and putting a single lane while we detour traffic and work on the road down there. Those of you familiar with that piece of the road know we've had difficulties over the years with springs and water under the freeway, and we've tried and tried different ways, and it really requires us to completely dig up the entire freeway and go down about 4 feet and rebuild that part of the freeway. And so when do you do that? You can't do it in the wintertime. You can't do it certain times of the year. You do it when people want to travel, and trying to predict with our models and so forth, we missed it Sunday night with our models. And so we're back to the drawing board trying to figure out how we can get people, especially on holiday weekends, through that section of freeway in a better than we did last Sunday.
That's Rakowitz's people's problem. They're supposed to build it right.
Yeah.
That was commenting on, it was the I-5 section south of Cottage Grove.
Yeah. My parents called me twice.
Well, they were
from the road.
It's probably the state senator's fault, isn't it? Who's the state senator down there? Oh, it's got to be Boyd's fault.
Kind of like when, when 84 was closed down because of slides, huh?
I'm going to move on with my update here. I'm going to try something a little bit different here. You've seen me up here talking with project updates in the past, so I'm trying to maybe liven up my presentation a little bit today. I've got a couple of videos embedded in here and a few other things, so hopefully with technology treats me well here. But I thought I'd start out with just more of a reminder, things we've talked about here in the past around funding and just what the outlook for funding is. Starting with what I call the mountain chart you've seen in the past, kind of looking at that investment in transportation we've made over the last decade. Craig was up here talking about how we do that in various cycles. This is kind of represents over the last 10 years some of those cycles, the OTIA programs, 1, 2, and 3, the JTA program. We've got some federal stimulus money in there, and then the continued investment in Connect Oregon is in there, and the most recent investment, and most of the projects you're going to hear me talking about is the Jobs and Transportation Act, which is playing itself out. So that's one highlight from this chart. One of the other highlights is you look at the bottom portion of this. This is our STIP federal money that is kind of almost what we take for granted from the federal government, what we use to rebuild roads with, to repave, to take care of our bridges, just to do the kind of the everyday projects that kind of keep the system operating. Those funds are, you know, in question. I'm going to talk about those here in a minute. But
is that all federal funds in the blue?
Predominantly, Mr. Chairman, yes. There's some a little bit of state money. Obviously, we have match money that's required with those federal projects, but that's on the order of 90% federal money that's in that blue section. So it's, I think about it as all of federal money. It really goes with what Congress does.
If you know, the bonding aside, if you looked at just the proportion of federal money to the state gas tax, what's the proportion?
In the blue section of this chart?
Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm going overall, what is
overall in our department's budget?
If we were just looking at the revenue stream, rather than the bonding, the extra bonding money, but if you're just looking at the revenue stream, the money that we would normally have to fund our programs.
the reason I'm hesitating a little bit is, so when we look at the gas tax and all our revenue, there's a big chunk that goes into our maintenance program. There's a big chunk that goes into operating the DMV and operating the department. And all that is state gas tax dollars that go into all that. We can't use federal money other than essentially capital projects. So our STIP, our money that goes into capital projects, all, essentially all of our federal money goes there. Our state gas tax goes into operating the system from maintenance to DMV to my salaries, so forth. All comes from the state gas tax piece. So really when we think about our STIP, especially going forward, coming out of the bonded piece, it's almost exclusively now going to be whatever Congress and federal does, because we have to take all our state funds, which is under the same pressures the federal revenue is under. We're having to use that to operate the department and keep our maintenance functions operating the way we need to have them operating. So inflation was one of the points I wanted to make on this chart. As you see, kind of embedded in there, what since 2000, what inflation has done to the buying power of those funds. And then that wedge kind of in there that I've got, I'll talk about here in the next slide, is kind of that question mark on the federal side. So if we look at that federal side, this is kind of that same time period of what the federal gas tax has done. And so it has, under the same challenges we have with the state gas tax, as we have people driving less, higher mile vehicles, so forth, the revenue is coming in under what was projected. And so those blue bars all the way through there are what is represented in the federal trust fund and what is coming in revenue for the federal gas tax. Those orange kind of jump-ups are what Congress has done to kind of patch the system together with general fund allocations at various times to keep the expenditures essentially close to steady over that time period. We are at one of those points again coming up in the next couple months where the federal trust fund is going to go into the negative and Congress is going to be forced to have to make another adjustment with either general fund or some other adjustment to keep us out of that red line there going down. So, but if you look at no action by Congress going forward, you see us having to go down to just those blue bars, and that represents about a 30% reduction in our STIP program. So back to the chart on the mountain graph, that blue total blue bar would go down about 30%, which represents that piece I've got out there and kind of the hash mark. So it's a trying time in transportation as far as planning our future. We're in the process of finalizing our draft STIP out to 2018. We were supposed to start development of our next STIP, selecting projects out to 2020, but we don't know how much federal funds actually we're going to have in August. So it makes it a little challenging, and our commission actually this last spring has put off the development of that next STIP until we get a little more certainty of these federal funds. We can do a better job planning how much revenue we can predict out into the future. Looking at our system, just again a reminder of where we are with the condition of our system. The bridges, while you see in the next several years where our projection is an increase in our condition of our bridges, largely from the OTIA-3 program. Long-term, just the amount of bridges that we have built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, just the sheer volume of those bridges, we can't keep up with the amount of revenue that we have to keep those bridges in good conditions. And we're going to see a decline in over the next several decades in our overall bridge conditions. On the pavement side, it's really more dependent on funding. And as you see those uncertainties in the federal side or projections of less revenue on the federal side, you're going to see our pavement conditions trend downward over that time period.
On the bridge side, in terms of those bridges, my perception, maybe this is wrong, is that we put a lot of effort into improving, getting back in shape through the various programs the last 10 years, the major transportation corridors, the two interstates, and I don't know about 97, but some of those. And we still hear about the bridges. Are most of the bridges that are in deteriorating shape on secondary roads?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We identified back in the Bridge Options Report in 2003 a $5 billion need in bridges, and the OTIA-3 program funded $1.3 billion in state bridges. But then we focused those, as your point, on the most strategic freight routes around the state, the interstates, Highway 97, the major freight routes around the state. And those are the ones we've secured up and why you see a slight uptick in the overall condition, but that overall condition is focused on improvement, is focused on those freight routes around the state. But there's a lot of bridges we have on our secondary highways that weren't addressed in the OT03, and those are the volume of bridges.
Do those include local bridges as well?
In our numbers here, we don't include local bridges, but they are under a similar type of situation as the state bridges are.
Okay. Thank you.
So getting into just a project update, I thought I'd turn us back to last February, a little different day than today when we were having snow and ice and other challenges. This is in the gorge. Happened a few days before the three-day weekend of President's holiday.
And that's Chuck Thompson's district.
Yeah,
yeah. You know,
Senator
just
Thompson,
can't keep those rocks under
we'll take
control.
Credit for these rocks that we had in the middle of I-84. We closed the freeway for about two and a half days. Had several challenges with that closure. State of Washington was dealing with their own challenges on Highway 14 on the other side of the gorge, trying to get traffic through there. The contractor, our staff did an excellent job in getting that back open. Here's a picture of some of the guys up there scaling the rocks to make sure it was safe. We could open the highway again. We spent about $500,000 just in those few days getting the highway back open. We're going to spend close to $2 million repairing this particular site. We've had an application in for federal reimbursement for those for some ER funds, emergency funds for this repair, but this is obviously something we hadn't planned for. Moving down 94 back towards Portland and the Sandy River, this is the last OTA3 bridge. I've mentioned the OTA3 bridge program a couple times. 365 bridges, $1.3 billion over 10 years. We're going to have a ribbon cutting on this bridge on June 11th, and it will represent the last ribbon cutting of all those bridges in the OTA3 bridge program. It's been an outstanding program for us, on time and under budget for the program. Something as a department we're very, very proud of. A couple of things about this particular project. As someone who has stared at a lot of pictures of bridges over the last 10 years, there's something missing from this particular picture. Normally when you see a bridge project, you see a lot of other bridges. You see detour structures, you see work bridges for cranes to go out on, and a lot of other bridges in the water as we work on the bridge. And this one, you don't see those. You don't see those things. And part of what we realized when we started to build the structure is in the Sandy River has a particular problem. When it rains a lot, it has a lot of debris flow that comes down that river. And by the time you build the detour structure, you build work bridges, you build the new bridge, you have the existing bridge, you essentially build a picket fence across the river, and it catches anything that comes down the river. And so we had to regroup and think about how we were going to build this particular bridge, as it was going to be under construction for a number of winter seasons and the risks it was going to provide to the system as well as to potential flooding in that area, that we had to come up with a different approach.
But what did that bridge end up costing?
This particular bridge was around $80 or $90 million. It was one of our more expensive bridges that we had in the program.
Not cheap.
So what we came up with was a way to launch the beams onto the bridge through these cranes that launched them kind of along the piers, rather than the cranes you see that swing them out over onto the piers. We have these cranes that lift them and launch them laterally. So it's a different technique that we use to eliminate those other structures that we have in the water. Another project that I've talked about here before is Sunrise Corridor, a very important project to that part of the state with all the industry in that area and just the congestion that represents. We have millions of hours of congestion that occurs in this area, and we've have this project on the drawing boards for a long time, and it's been great with with the JTA funds to begin construction of this new alignment from the Milwaukee Expressway, bypassing essentially the Clackamas area and reconnecting with Highway 212. As you've been driving on 205, I'm sure you've seen some of the work that's going on. Here's one of the new structures that will be part of the new interchange that's being constructed. Kerr Contractors is the contractor on this project. Here you can see that same bridge. Point here, this is that same bridge you just saw a picture of. The new alignment goes out, if you can follow my arrow there, goes out this direction and connect into 219 in that direction. So you get a little bit of perspective just how big this project is. We scheduled to complete in 2016 with this project. here's a similar view from the other direction, looking.
And the approximate cost of the whole Sunrise project?
This particular project is total costs around $130 million. $100 million of that is JTA funds. And this builds just a segment of the overall project that we had identified in the environmental document. The other project, or the additional phases of this project, would continue this route out to Rock Creek, which is further to the east. Rookwood Road Interchange, here's another one that I've talked about in the past. Here's a picture of what that's going to look like as it improves capacity at this interchange and the growth that we've seen in that part of Washington County. Here's a photo from a few months ago. You can start to see the realignment of some of the roads to improve performance at the interchange. And then in the upper left there, the new loop ramp that's going to go, and you can see some of the construction happening there. It's a little closer photo of that important project. We've had a few conflicts with utilities in our design, which has slowed us down a little bit. The contractor, Wildish, has been great to work with, and we hope this summer and through this fall make up some of that time and get back on track. But we're about a year away from completing this project. Newburgh-Dundee. Here's the overall project. Again, another one we've identified, a much larger project, but with the Jobs and Transportation Act to be able to fund just over about a $240 million total project cost. $190 million of that is coming from JTA funds. The project in the bottom, the phase in the bottom there is what we're building with these funds. Here's how we've broken that up. We've a very large project. We've tried to break up into smaller contracts to keep local contractors competitive on this project. We've had some work out there already doing some of the environmental work, culvert work, some of the base work on the project. But we've divided the major work up into two sections. The orange section there on the left and the yellow section will be two major projects going to construction this summer. In fact, next week we'll open bids on the orange section, and the yellow section will be later this summer. But we'll have two contractors out there working at the same time. So here I thought I'd give you a little bit of one of the videos
produced
on this particular project.
Trucks have been hauling dirt, rock, and heavy equipment in and out of Newburgh and Dundee as construction of the Newburgh-Dundee bypass is well underway. While there is much work left to do, the project is making progress and moving forward. Phase 1 of the bypass includes a brand new roadway that will extend for about 4 miles between Oregon 219 in Newburgh and Oregon 99W just south of Dundee, and will include one lane in each direction and new signalized intersections at both ends. As you can imagine, this is a large and complicated project. In Dundee, the bypass will connect to Oregon 99W. A large bridge will be built that crosses over the railroad and highway at this location. Let's show you what has been accomplished so far. Here, you can see the areas that have already been cleared for the roadway. At the Dundee end, 500,000 lineal feet of wick drains were installed to draw water from underground, and heavy gravel has been added to speed up natural settling to ensure bridges are built on compact ground. The first bridge for the project will be complete by spring of 2014. In January, 755-foot-long beams were hauled into Dundee. Crews used two large cranes to set the 7 beams in place, one by one, over 2 days. 10 bridges will be built as part of Phase 1. This first bridge is approximately 200 feet long and crosses over a small creek. Traveling east towards Newburgh, we cross many acres of property that ODOT has purchased for the bypass. In Newburgh, the bypass will skirt the southern edge of town on a 2,200-foot-long bridge crossing over the railroad tracks and College and River Streets. The bypass will be tucked between 11th Street and the paper mill. Looking toward where the bypass will connect to Oregon 219, neighbors have seen a lot of change. The area between Winooski and Oregon 219 has been excavated down to allow for the flight path for the neighboring airfield. A few large stormwater ponds, some up to 35 feet deep, have also been excavated. Runoff from the roadway will be directed to the ponds for filtration that will prevent harmful pollution from getting into our streams and creeks. A small tributary of Hess Creek has been placed into a new 300-foot-long culvert. Great care has been taken to protect fish during the reconfiguration of their habitat. There is much work left to do before Phase 1 is complete. We appreciate the patience of neighbors and the traveling public as work continues. For more information on construction of the first phase of the bypass or planning for the full bypass, please visit our website.
Thought that video did a nice job kind of explaining in summary the project. Moving on to the Woodburn Interchange project, another one I've talked about, and I'm sure you've seen as you drive up and down I-5 the work that's been going on as we improve that particular interchange. Here's a photograph from earlier this spring showing the development, as you can see, of the loop ramps, and each of those quadrants start to take shape. Looking more closely at those loop ramps in the two quadrants. One thing you'll notice if you're out next week, maybe at 2 o'clock in the morning driving the freeway, we'll have the freeway closed and we'll be setting beams across for the new bridge. If you're not out at 2 o'clock in the morning, drive by in the morning, you'll just see they've showed up overnight and see the new bridges, new beams for those bridges. One thing we have, see if my technology works here, one thing we have here on this project is we have live cameras. So if you want to see work that's going on out there at any time, you can pull up a couple of live cameras that we have out there. So that's some of the work that's going on on 219.
I have a question on this project. With all these improvements, are the numbers still going to be over capacity even after the project is finished? What I'm saying is, it seems like we've done the improvement, but still the car numbers and the problem with the mall is still not going to be totally fixed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jordan, we're going to fix 90 to 95% of the problem. We're not going to fix the day after Thanksgiving. We're not going to fix the those very peak volumes that's created from the outlet mall. To make an improvement to address those would be a very even more significant investment at this interchange to address all those problems. But for those users that use this day in and day out, this is going to function very well and be a much upgraded improvement what we have out there today.
My concerns are the people that are leaving the mall. You know how they have to go up, then take the left, and then usually most of the time take a left to go back to the freeway. That little segment in there is not going to be, those numbers will stay the same. Is that not correct?
Senator Jordan, we're doing improvements in that section. I don't have, top of my head, exact numbers, but we are. The project extends past that intersection where you come back onto the highway from the outlet mall. So that intersection, as well as back towards the interchange, all that will be widened and improved as part of this project.
Okay. But, well, I'm talking about the street. When you leave the mall, you got to go up, take a left, and then take a left. So
and go back to. So here shows the improvements that we'll be making.
Yeah.
So we will be making improvements here. We will be making improvements here. But you're coming from the outlet mall, you will still continue to have to access here.
Yeah, okay.
And your access point will be the same. But these approaches will be improved, as well as 219 in this section will also be improved as part of the project. Pioneer Mountain to Eddyville project on Highway 20, another one that I've talked about. I thought I'd just give you a continued update on that project. We've opened bids for the major portion of the work that's going to be taking place over the next 2 years. Those bids came in significantly under what we had budgeted for, so we continue to remain optimistic, and our confidence grows as far as being able to deliver this project and complete it within the money that we have available.
When is the completion data set on that now?
It's, Senator Jordan, set for 2016. I have a short video here I thought I'd show, too, and I think it'll probably answer some of those questions for you. Just give you a little.
Since 2012, when ODOT took control of the design and delivery of the U.S. 20 project in Lincoln County, three new phases of construction have been completed on time and within the estimated budget. The construction and placement of more than 3,200 feet of culvert to replace four bridges was among the construction completed in 2013. In addition, 90 miles of horizontal drains have now been constructed, reducing subsurface water pressures that cause landslide activity. Installation of more than 3 300 ground monitoring instruments has been completed, allowing ODOT to gather precise ground movement data. By taking an observational approach, ODOT is now able to accurately pinpoint where and what additional slide mitigation is needed. Two more phases of construction will take place in 2014 and 2015. One will move 2.5 million yards of earth and rock, forming the unfinished roadbed. It will focus on slide mitigation by installing 20 more miles of horizontal drains, constructing 415 ground acres, and constructing large rock buttresses with some of the 600,000 tons of rock created during earlier phases. The second phase will improve habitat for fish and wildlife, adding to the expected total of 20 mitigation sites when the project is completed. With a total estimated price tag of $365.78 million, the 5.5 miles of the new US 20, bypassing 10 miles of the old highway, already includes 8 completed bridges and half the roadway constructed and paved. When complete, it will offer a straighter and more efficient connection between the valley and the coast, with wide shoulders, more passing opportunities, and allowing for modern freight travel. Traffic on the new highway remains scheduled for 2016.
I-5 Beltline, another project I've talked about. Project continues to move forward. We're actually taking out one of the loop ramps in this interchange to improve the merging on I-5 and make other modifications to increase the capacity. This is Unit 3. The first two units have improvements have been completed. This one's more focused on improving Beltline and the new structure, as well as connections to and from the north with this project. Here's one of the projects. From this winter, we have a Unit 4 that's going to follow. We've been having some conversations with the community about just some of the aspects and the needs of that Unit 4. Likely there's pieces of that we need to do, but there's other pieces that maybe we can repurpose those funds to other improvements on the Beltline or in the area. And we'll be back with you talking to you more about that next session if those conversations continue to move forward. So this is not a photograph you see every day. This is downtown Sisters, and if you've been over in Sisters the last couple months, you haven't been able to drive through downtown Sisters. It's actually a picture that I took on my cell phone when I was over there about a month ago visiting some of the businesses and seeing how they were doing with the road completely closed for a couple of months. We started a conversation several years ago with the community about having to repave downtown Sisters and just how were we going to do that. Obviously, the businesses were very concerned and nervous about that, and we worked with them to figure out a way we could accomplish that. We started doing this work essentially as soon as it stopped snowing in March. The contractor's been working virtually around the clock to get the roadway back open. What's interesting about this project, I got a short video on this one too to give you a little bit of perspective here, but we've been able to work with the community and get about 6 or 7 different grants to do more than just our paving project. We've been able to redo the sidewalks, planter strips, and really beautify the entire downtown area. And I think it's going to be a project that many other communities are going to be jealous of when we're complete. This is from actually last Friday. The director was over there, and we had a ribbon cutting of getting traffic back on the road. As you can see in the picture, there's still much work to be done. Some of the sidewalks there that they're standing on, the paving blocks need to be completed, the sidewalks, so forth. But we got actually traffic back in the community before Memorial Day weekend, which was our commitment to the community.
Wait.
Senator Gerard?
Yeah, you know where the bypass comes in on Sisters? Is there going to be a light there?
Senator Gerard, so on this end, or the west end of the project, we put a temporary signal up by the shopping center.
I was thinking actually at the other end. of the bypass. So it'd be the east end.
During the detour, we did not put a traffic signal in there, and it actually seemed to work okay during that. I think long term, we're still having conversations with the community about that intersection as well as the one on the other end at Barclay, on whether we have traffic signals or roundabouts. But we need improvements at both those intersections in the future, and we have ongoing discussions with the community on what those are going to look like.
Yep.
Well, I was doing good with technology until I got to this one. It is a nice video of downtown Sisters showing some of the work that is going on. Again, it's kind of remarkable as you go through Sisters today and all the traffic and all the pedestrians and everything, to go in there and see nothing but heavy equipment, and then to go into the businesses and talk to the store owners and how happy they are with the improvements that are going on, and how well it's going, and how well the contractor, Knife River, is doing with the project, as well as our staff, and working with them, communicating with them, and getting through a couple of months of difficult work, but it's going to be, again, something I think they're going to be very, very proud of when we're completed. Another project over in the
Senator Edwards, excuse me, Paul.
On the Sisters project, the traffic that is currently detoured a street back, I guess it'd be a street to the south. Is it going to go back to, once the project's done, it's going to go back to just two-way through the middle of town, or the highway, not one way going one direction and a block back going the other direction or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, yes, we're going to put traffic back to the way it was. During construction, we actually had eastbound traffic one block over, westbound traffic was in one block the other direction, and then we detoured truck traffic over on this detour that I was talking about that kind of bypassed the area completely. And that seemed to work very well during the spring construction. During summer, during the peak weekends, it probably would overload the system, but it worked well for the 2 months while we had the downtown closed. Murphy Road is on the south end of Bend, where the Bend Parkway comes back into 97. If you're familiar with that area, we have a traffic signal at that end. This project does a couple of things. It takes that traffic signal out and replaces it with an overcrossing, as well as provides a connection across 97 and a badly needed east-west connection for the city of Bend. We've been busy working this spring. Here's the beams going in place for that overcrossing that's going to replace this traffic signal. And here's the overcrossing for Murphy Road, which will provide that better connectivity for the community. Fern Valley Interchange, Southern Oregon. This is just south of Medford. Project we've been working with the community on for a number of years. Our design is one that's going to be an innovative design, one we haven't seen in Oregon or really on the West Coast before. And we have more time. Maybe one of my future updates, I can go into this a little bit more. But this is a design that is a very high functioning capacity-wise, but has a very small footprint. You actually drive and cross over at this point with a traffic signal and go on the other side of what you would normally be on, and then cross back over on this side of the interchange in a way that makes the interchange function very, very efficiently. That project will be a two-year project, and we'll be set to open that in 2016. So as we get closer, I'll give you more information on exactly how that's working. Here's a couple shots just of some of the work that's beginning this spring on that project. Lastly, I thought I'd close talking about work zones. We head into a summer construction season. Work zones are very dangerous places. We've seen across the country work zone fatalities have increased every year for the last several years. In Oregon, we've actually bucked that trend. They've actually gone down, but there are places where as a worker, you're seven times more likely to be injured or killed in that occupation than an average occupation. As a driver, four out of five of the fatalities that we see in work zones are drivers or their passengers. So there are areas that we've put some new focus towards. As an agency, the director has called together a work group that consists of AGC, Oregon Trucking Association, Oregon State Police, and our staff, and trying to figure out how we can do a better job of improving our work zones. One of our focuses has been on nighttime paving operation. We do a lot of nighttime paving because of the congestion issues, but it also creates some safety issues with those workers being very, very close to traffic going by at high speeds and oftentimes impaired drivers. Mr. Chairman, if we have time, I got one more short video I'd like to show, assuming my technology works. This is a video that we've produced internally for our maintenance staffs. It's a video that is on I-5. If you're familiar with the Siskiyou Summit going into California, we had a maintenance crew doing a paving operation in a runaway truck, lost its brakes, and went about 70 miles an hour directly through our work zone and potentially could have wiped out the entire crew. Fortunately for the crew, they were able to avoid anybody getting hurt. But this is a short reenactment that happened, a 2 or 3 minute video here. And we're using with our maintenance crews just to reinforce the dangers that we have out there on the road. I thought you might find that interesting.
Working on Oregon's roads can be a dangerous job. Think about your safety each and every day. I know I do.
You know, we figure he was probably doing between 70 to 75 miles an hour when he came through the work zone because he had no brakes. I just about lost my whole entire crew that day.
I was actually in the hallway truck for the grinder, and we just made the last pass with the grinder, so I pulled up against the barrier, and I was facing uphill, and I was standing on the barrier, and some equipment below me was repositioning the grader and the loader, and I look up the hill at traffic coming down, and I see a truck smoking pretty bad. I thought it was on fire.
We were standing right out there in the middle of that flow lane, right at this location when the truck came through.
Here comes a 80,000 pound, 53 foot truck trailer combination out of control coming off the summit. His brakes were just smoking, and he goes by and it was the smoke was amazing. Then it was all over, and we were looking around and just trying to figure out what had just happened actually.
There's close calls, but when they're so close that you feel them, and that's what that was. I mean, you could feel the air off the truck, and he was by before you could really even think about what was going on.
First, he was taking out the cones as he was coming down through here, and in the summertime, these cones, they get warm, they get very flexible, but the speed that he hit these at, he was snapping them. So cones were just flying in pieces. As he came down through here, we didn't jump. Everybody dove over the barrier. It was just to get to a safe zone as quick as possible.
We always know our escape routes. We spot each other. We take, you know, when we're doing lane closures or whatever we're doing, we have our signs, our cones. You know, we try to protect ourselves. But, you know, a cone's a cone.
The only thing separating you from traffic doing 65 miles an hour is a 3 foot cone. That's a lot to take seriously.
Keep your head in the game. You know, always be aware of your surroundings and your escape routes, and look at your more experienced people and kind of stay close to them so you can see, you know, what they've learned over the years and what you can do to protect yourself out there.
After the incident, once we did an accident or a near miss accident investigation, we went through the process that we went through that day, and our work zone was set up correctly. We had spotters in the right places. We had done everything correctly that day.
We have families to go home to. I got two kids I want to come to them every night, and people drive like that, and chances go down to me going home every night.
You never know what you're going to face each and every day. Be ready. Be prepared. And expect the unexpected. After all, it can be a dangerous job.
Good, that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Any other questions? Good report, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so Patrick, let's move to the last item, the resiliency report.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think all of our panelists are here.
Okay.
You want to invite them?
Would you like to join us, the resiliency panel? So I think we got Paul, Ruben, Mr. Rubin, and Mr. Johnson. Welcome. Whoever wants to start.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jeff Rubin. I'm the emergency manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon Resilience Task Force. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon on that task force. I do not have a great deal of formal remarks. We just wanted to give you a little update, but I'm certainly happy to take questions. We've been meeting since November. We have our deadline of issuing a report in April, which we will, of course, meet. We've been trying to narrow down a pretty large list of what most people consider high priorities to something that we can at least get started on. While we're still pairing that in preparation for our report, we will address all of the items that were in Senate Bill 33, as well as a few that we've come up with on our own. We know that one of our highest priority items is going to be trying to find a home for seismic resilience within state government so that we don't have to keep doing one-year task forces. You know, the Oregon Resilience Plan was a one-year group of volunteers. Our task force is a one-year group of volunteers, and we need something more sustainable so that someone can keep an eye on whatever the recommendations and priorities are. We have reached out to a variety of state agencies and administrators beyond those that are represented on the task force. So I've gotten a lot of really useful input. Dogami, DLCD, education. We've actually written a letter to Superintendent Saxton requesting some input from them in terms of how they plan to move forward on a few seismic resilience issues, both in terms of curriculum and physical facilities. And we're also working closely with Dogami, both in terms of making sure we're acting on the best available science and trying to take advantage of the work they've already done in one of our most hazardous areas, which is the tsunami inundation zone. Beyond that, like I said, we'll be coming back to you as a whole in just a few months with our formal report, including our priority recommendations.
Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. We're going to go through and talk to you a little bit about the transportation component of the resilience plan. Bruce Johnson, our state bridge engineer, has been very involved in this, and he's going to give you a fairly detailed presentation about the transportation component of this, and I'm talking more than just highways. And then I'm going to wrap it up with a little bit about what we've been doing within ODOT to try to kind of get our arms around this problem and how we're going to address it from a more truly highway standpoint. So we'll start with Bruce talking about the transportation component. Actually, you two might want to switch places so Bruce can have. Give you the mouse to go through.
Yes. Yes, Paul said, my name's Senator Byron, Bruce Johnson, and committee, Bruce Johnson, State Bridge Engineer, Oregon DOT. I'm going to give you some of the background that led to the formation of the task force that Jeff is working on. And what I've shown here on this first slide is the Markham Bridge in downtown Portland. Just happens to be one of the first ones that we did seismic retrofit on. And it's just because a lot of the infrastructure that we built in Oregon was done before we knew about seismic design. That was one of them. And the solution to that is retrofitting to bring it up to seismic standards. So the transportation portion of the resilient plan, as Jeff said, we worked on this for a year. And we had a lot of input, broad participation from a number of the transportation groups throughout Oregon. Ports were represented primarily by Port of Portland, Port of Astoria, and Coos Bay, as well as It's really good information we had from the U.S. Coast Guard on some of the other ports. The universities helped us on the transportation portion as well as some consultants. And we had good participation from about three dozen of the local agencies, including some cities and counties, as well as the various state transportation organizations. So the resilient plan component for transportation was built on some basic concepts, first of which, based on some actual performance of retrofitted structures in California and Washington, we know that retrofitting works. It's a proven concept that we can increase the resiliency of structures by doing retrofitting. The other thing that we've learned from some of the earthquakes that occurred around the world is that retrofitting has a very significant impact in a couple of areas. And one is we know that a certain number of people are going to lose their life in a major catastrophic earthquake. But what we really need to think hard about are the secondary losses that may occur because we just can't reach them. And so there's an important aspect here in terms of resiliency and retrofitting to allow us to reach people who need help, who we could save their life and make their lives more comfortable. The other thing that we've learned, and Paul will talk a little bit more about this in the second part of this presentation, is that retrofitting can have a very significant impact on reducing the loss of your overall economy in the state. And we have some numbers and studies and recommendations with respect to that. However, you should be doing retrofitting on a strategic basis, and that's one of the points I want to make on the highway side is we have a lot of information about highway vulnerability, and we have done some retrofitting, but it has been sporadic, bit by bit around the state and not strategic in a way that would do us the most good. So a solution is retrofitting for structures that were built prior to when seismic design was put into the codes. And that was around in Oregon around the late 80s. So structures built from, say, 1990 on are designed to seismic code, and prior to that, they weren't. We do retrofitting in a couple of phases, and primarily because of the cost and available funding.
Excuse me, Senator.
I actually have a kind of a technical question. When we talk about a Cascadia event, usually we're talking about a magnitude 8 earthquake. What, on the tsunami side of it, which is going to do a lot of damage, I've never heard, what is the projection of the size of the tsunami that we're trying to prepare for?
I refer to Dogami on that, and Jeff may want to chime in here on this too.
Worst case scenario, you're looking at something larger than what you saw in Japan. I mean, depending on exactly where the quake is, you could have something taller than 60 feet. And remember, it's not just a single wave, it's a series, and it's really a temporary increase in sea level. So rather than a big wave, think of it as this surge, sea level temporarily increasing by 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, depending on where you are, but the peak could be greater than 60.
Whoa. Okay.
And I just might say...
So how high is your house?
Not 60. I guess I'll get flood insurance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girardi, just my two cents on that question. Dogami publishes tsunami inundation maps, and my understanding is those current maps that were just updated in the last few months are based on a 9.0 Cascadia earthquake. So that's the relative terms that they're talking about for those inundation maps. We have two phases. Phase one is what we call life safety. It just keeps the bridge from falling off of its supports. And then the second phase is actually protects the superstructure from failure. And the problem that we have is that we've only had sufficient funding in the bridge program, at least, to do this phase one seismic retrofit on most of our bridges. We haven't done phase two, which means that a lot of our structures will not be serviceable, can't be used after an event. The other thing that's different about Oregon in the Cascadia event is the national code is set around what we call a 1,000-year event. And it just prevents collapse of the structure, so it's life safety. In Oregon, we have another criteria which we call serviceability, and it's a 500-year event. It's lower than 1,000, but when you design for serviceability, it actually ends up being a more strict requirement. And the reason we do that is to capture the Cascade event, which is around a 350 to 500-year return period, so that our bridges that are retrofitted for phase two will actually be usable within a short time after an event. Here's what I mean by seismic retrofit. You can see I've got various types of retrofitting here. The big problem that we have with earthquakes, first of all, is that the superstructure where you drive tends to fall off of the columns because we have horizontal shaking going on this way, and the ground is moving sideways, and the massive superstructure tends to, by inertia, want to stay where it's at. And so there's a lot of force induced in those vertical columns. So one of the things we do with phase one, which is just life safety, is we just tie the superstructure together to the columns so it won't fall off. That's relatively inexpensive. If you have available funding and you want to go all the way and have the bridge be serviceable, then you have to do this phase two, which strengthens the columns. If it's a new design, then we have proven methods of making it resilient by adding this horizontal steel and these spirals around, and that prevents the collapse. If it's a retrofit issue where the bridge is already in service, then what we do is we put a steel casing around it, and so you prevent this sideways motion from causing failure in the column. And I got an example of some of that. Here's a bridge collapse from 2010 in the Chile earthquake. And you can see what I mean by preventing life safety. So the superstructure was not adequately tied to the abutment. And during this horizontal movement, the abutment or the superstructure pulled off and collapsed. Here's an example of what phase two is intended to do. This would strengthen the column so that as you have this horizontal reverse motion going on, you would not end up with this kind of a failure. The column would be more resilient. But this is a much more expensive fix than the tying it together. The other thing that was a little bit new and different about the resilient study that was done for the highway side was for the first time we looked at landslides. We previously had focused our attention on bridges, those being probably the most vulnerable during an earthquake, but we did categorize our unstable slopes and areas for potential landslide in this study, and we have some good information about what it would take to retrofit some of our landslides to make our highways usable after an event. So for the study, for the resilience study, most of the modes looked at Oregon in these four categories. And as you heard and are aware, the most severe category is right along the coast in the tsunami zone. Those folks, are going to have a double whammy. They're going to have very strong ground motions shaking the earth back and forth and up and down. And then 18 to 20 minutes later, a large surge wave coming in and causing additional damage. Then you've got the orange zone, which is a very strong ground motion area. You've got the Willamette Valley, which is sort of moderate. And then central and eastern Oregon, which is fairly low ground motion, low vulnerability. So I'm going to just briefly touch on the different modes and summarize what we learned in the resilience study for them. We did look at railroads, and as you're probably aware, we have two major trunk line railroads serving Oregon. We've got the BNSF going up basically close to Highway 97 in Central Oregon, and then along the Columbia River serving the Portland area, and then going up further north on the Washington side. You've got the Union Pacific, which also comes up from California in a shared line from Klamath Falls to Chemult, and then the UP takes off basically along US 50 or Oregon 58, and then up the Central Valley, serving Portland that way. So what we learned is that the railroads haven't done a very detailed assessment of the vulnerability of their systems, but they've done an overview, sort of program level. This section here from Chemult to California, down to Klamath Falls in California, is fairly resilient. There's a few rock slides potentially in that area. The BNSF up through Central Oregon is fairly resilient. There's also one major landslide and probably just a handful of bridges that would need to be retrofitted. The area along the Columbia River is very problematic. There's a number of bridges that are very seismically vulnerable, and also a number of slides that would have to be fixed. It's feasible to strengthen this area, but fairly expensive. Looking at the Union Pacific, when you cut across from Chemult down into Eugene, that area along Oregon 58, they had a hard time even saying it was feasible to harden and make that route resilient. The cost was enormous. It would take a lot of reconstruction of the entire railroad. There's so many slides and vulnerable bridges in this area that the cost was really unreasonable. The Central Valley line could potentially be made resilient, but you know, without that service hooking in over to California, we get little from that. Most of the short line railroads in the Central Valley and off to the coast are sort of a barely break-even standpoint, and it was really difficult for them to envision ever making their systems resilient to an earthquake. So railroads have some significant issues making their system resilient. We did look at the airports also. There's a lot of vulnerabilities for the Portland International Airport, which I'll talk to a little bit in a minute, but they did end up concluding that the Redmond Airport would likely be serviceable, and that's one of the reasons in the FEMA preparation for response to a catastrophe in Oregon, the Redmond Airport is designated as the main supply source coming in from out of state. There are five airports in the valley which have some resiliency, and so an emergency situation right now, prior to a lot of investment in increasing resiliency, is that most goods and people would be coming into Redmond. There would be fixed wing access to about five airports in the valley, and then from there everything would be rotary or helicopter service in terms of rescue and supplies to the rest of the state. There's one airport in the on the coast that has a fairly high level of resiliency. That's at Cape Blanco, and there would be a pretty reliable helicopter service into Newport. Otherwise, most of the airports on the coast are not going to be usable.
After Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I'm old enough to remember the big flood in 48. They closed the Portland airport, and at that time the big planes went into Salem. My wife says she remembers as a little girl going over to the Salem airport because she lived down here and watching the big planes come in 1948 during the Vanport flood. Why Redmond and not Salem? Salem's a lot closer to the population centers of the Willamette Valley.
Salem would need some investment in terms of retrofitting to guarantee that the tower would be operational. And so the current plan, based on current resiliency, is Redmond is the most reliable. Now, they are planning, like I said, in terms of servicing the valley, that Salem would be one of the five. But it wouldn't be the center, because there's some investment needed to make it reliable.
Well, in 1948, there weren't jets. They were a big four-motor propeller airplanes at that time, so that would be different than having it accessible to the big new jets.
Yeah. I'd say, I believe Salem also has a runway length problem for the larger jets. But yeah, there are five that would be serviced and available for goods and supplies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What, just thumbnail overview, what's assessed in determining airport readiness or resiliency? You mentioned tower. Okay, so in Salem, the tower would need to be retrofitted to be more seismically stable, I guess. What other type of things are you looking at? Just curious.
Yeah, a number of them have what we call a liquefaction problem. So the underlying soil is silty or sandy, and so during a shaking event, it tends to liquefy and has what we call lateral flow, so it slides off to the side or just subsides. And some of the airports, that subsidence is not uniform. So you'd have not a flat surface in order for fixed-wing airplane to land.
Right.
So there's some of the airports that would work well for helicopters, but just not for fixed-wing. And that's one of the big issues with Portland International Airport, is the liquefaction and the underlying soils would cause this differential settlement. So we also looked at the ports. We had some pretty good information from three of the ports. And the general situation on the ports is those in the Portland area are subject to pretty strong ground motions and mostly would be not usable. East of, say, Camas, they're in much better shape. The ground motions are lower, and they probably would be usable. Most of the ports to the west of Portland would have so much damage that they would not be accessible. The other issue is we did work with the Corps of Engineers looking at the Columbia River and in terms of its vulnerability. And it's a dredge channel, you may know, but the slopes of the dredging are really steep. And there's a thought and a concern that those
fill in.
Yeah, would fill in. And so deep draft vessels along the Columbia River would be very problematic after a major cascade event, in addition to the fact that we understand that the Astoria Bridge, the Longview Bridge, and the I-5 Interstate Bridge in Portland would all collapse and basically block the channel from deep draft shipping.
Senator Drew.
I have another technical question for Dogami, and that is, The fault line is out to sea a fair distance, and you say that that's a 9, or let's say it's an 8, because I think that's probably more realistic. That's an 8 out there. What would it be in Portland if it was an 8 on the fault line? About what would be the earthquake strength in Portland?
I'll center the planning scenario that we chose to adopt with the Oregon Resilience Plan and that we're also using for this is actually a magnitude 9. So that's what our projections are based on. The magnitude doesn't change, but with location, but the intensity of shaking, you're still looking at within the inland valleys, particularly in the northern valleys, possibly more than 4 minutes of shaking. And even though the shaking wouldn't be as intense as you would get on the coast, you would have really substantial liquefaction. That's where a lot of the damage would come from, in terms of both structures, transportation routes, all the buried infrastructure like water mains, pipelines, etc. City of Portland alone in the resilience plan estimated about 20,000 underground breaks, and that's mostly due to liquefaction. That lessens as you go south in the valley. Eugene wouldn't have the same degree of liquefaction damage, but you're still looking at very intense shaking in a state that doesn't have a lot of its built structures designed for that.
I'm kind of curious why we used a 9, because maybe I'm wrong, but what's the biggest earthquake on record right now? Isn't it like an 8.2 or something?
Actually, the two biggest actually all the really large ones called great earthquakes are subduction zone earthquakes. So the largest recorded with modern instrumentation was a 9.5 off the coast of Chile. The Good Friday quake off of Alaska, we just passed 50th anniversary of that. That was, I think, a 9.4. Right. Japan's that caused the big tsunami in 2011, 9.0. Chile, 2010, 8.8. Indian Ocean tsunami, 9 point something.
Okay.
So is there any estimate on what the one, what is it, 1700 was the last big one off the Oregon coast?
Senator, there's no magnitude estimate. It's just a ballpark. It's probably close to a 9, but that's a lot of conjecture. And there's still some research disagreement in terms of which part of the fault the subduction zone would activate and how bad the earthquake would be. You can get a more frequent recurrence with a slightly smaller quake. But for the purposes of our planning, we said we need to focus on something and decided to shoot for what would be close to the worst case, which would be the most of the fault unzipping, which would be a 9.
And that's the one that's on about a 500-year cycle?
Ballpark, 300 to 500.
But back to the original question, if it's a 9 out there, roughly what would it be in Portland?
The way magnitude is defined, it doesn't change with place. It's measured where the earthquake happens. So there's a different scale called Mercalli shaking intensity, and it's just based on what things are like, what type of damage is done, what people feel. And for the coast, you would have scale goes 1 to 12, with 12 being essential devastation. On the coast, you would have shaking probably in the 10 to 11 range. Even in the inland valleys, you would get shaking anywhere from 6 to 9 or 10, and combined with a liquefaction, that would still be enough to generate really substantial damage. Just looking at the amount of shaking they've had from the other subduction zone quakes, that's it's a ballpark estimate, but it would be really long and really damaging.
So this, I'm sorry, I don't want to. I'm really kind of confused then, because if we build a bridge, I mean, we're talking about the Columbia River crossing, building it at 2 and 8. How do you measure that then, when the fault line is, I don't know, 200 miles off or something like that?
I'll point it.
Yeah, because I'm getting a little bit confused here, because I mean, you can have quakes all over the place, but I mean, if you're going to build something to take on this big Cascadia event, how do you? I mean, it's going to be different in Eastern Oregon, obviously, than what it's going to be in Portland, and that's where my question lies.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, I don't want to get too technical here, so raise your hand if I do, but there's another way to look at these intensity things, and that's what we call the actual ground motion that you design a bridge for. And this is that horizontal shaking I was talking about, and it shakes, and it actually induces a force. And so when you design a bridge, you're really looking at forces. So if you were out on the coast, that horizontal movement has a force that's around 3/4 to 0.8 of the total weight of the structure. So we call that 3/4 of a G. And that's out on the coast. Those are pretty high forces going sideways. In the Portland area, it's around 0.25 to maybe 0.3. So it's about a third of that horizontal force. And we have very good information that gives us those ground motions that we design structures for based on historical earthquakes and the distance from the earthquake. So in the Portland area, we're the older structures prior to 1990, they were designed for something like 0.06 to 0.1, so like a tenth of the weight of the structure moving horizontally. So when a big Cascadia comes, you're going to have forces that are like 3 times higher than that. And they were just not designed for those sideways forces. But we do design for them now. And as I mentioned, retrofitting is a way that takes account of those horizontal forces, and we can add some things to the structure that were not originally designed for.
Yeah, and Senator, I should point out that Dogami's seismic hazard maps are actually based on that. So there's a map for that magnitude 9 scenario. But what it'll show is the shaking intensities, and that's really what we go on. You can also map liquefaction potential, which is a little tougher. But everything that, that we base our hazard maps on is on impact as opposed to just a number.
Most of the discussion we've had is focused on the big Cascadia event. How about the smaller ones we had, like the 93 one that we had damage here and other, and some of the other ones? Do we worry about those?
We're
designing structures for them now, and the retrofitting that we do takes into account those crustal events also. Those were about 5.9, 6.0 events. There was one in Klamath Falls and one in Scotts Mills. In each case, there was one bridge that was damaged. It was pretty minor damage. We were able to repair it and open the bridge within a matter of a few weeks.
Okay. Outlost the Pioneer.
We're going to have that discussion later about this building.
That's part of the reason I asked the question.
Drop, cover, and hold.
Go ahead.
Okay, so continuing on the coastal ports, we had most of the information we had on the coastal ports came from the Coast Guard. It turns out that the ports really haven't done very many assessments except for Yquinna Bay at Newport. There has been a study done, and this is an indication of the intensity of damage around the port. The darker colors indicate more damage and higher ground motions and higher levels of tsunami. But the bottom line from the Coast Guard was that all of the coastal ports, the facilities, would not be usable after an event. And it was not only because of the strong ground shaking, but because of the tsunami. So the response, the emergency response plan for the coast, of course, I told you from the east, we're coming from Redmond Airport into five major airports in the valley. The plan for the coast is that hopefully the federal government or somebody would anchor big ships off the coast, and supplies and personnel would be carried by basically beach landing craft, because the ports would not be accessible.
Is the big bridge over Yquinna, would that stand an earthquake?
No, that bridge was designed and built in the 30s to very small horizontal loads, and it has very poor details for earthquakes. So the major bay bridges, all of them, you know, they were all built back in the 30s, and we're not expecting any of them to survive a major earthquake.
This is good news, Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, I want to have a house in Depot Bay.
What type of interaction is there with the federal government on this? Are they represented in the study effort, or do we have folks that are participating in their study efforts? Because you used the word hopefully. You said hopefully the federal government would anchor ships out there with supplies and bring them in. And so I'm wondering,
there are active studies going on in terms of emergency response in Oregon. It's centered around FEMA, and they interact primarily with the Emergency Response Center Committee in Portland. So there is a plan, and there have been some studies on what response would look like. It's kind of like transportation funding. I don't know, you know, until you get there, you don't really know what you have.
Yeah, we've actually, within the metro area and also the state level, we've gotten a variety of briefings, both from FEMA and state, who are doing joint planning, their Cascadia playbook, in terms of not what the first few hours are going to be like, because that's a local response, but what the plans are to bring in support eventually. That's why the staging areas were designated. But it's not that the feds are going to come in and save the day. It's going to be very difficult to get supplies around. What part of what makes the transportation component so important is the ability to serve affected areas afterwards and how quickly we can get that back into service. And that's what the ORP tried to describe.
Go ahead.
If there were a Cascadia event, how far north would be affected and how far south? So does that include Washington and Northern California, or does that, I'm not familiar enough with the fault line?
Senator, the fault actually runs from offshore British Columbia down to Northern California. If we did get the magnitude 9, if the fault basically unzipped for the better part of its length, you'd have most of the northwest coast affected from BC down to Northern California, and obviously the tsunami would reach ultimately across the Pacific, but within that scenario, the Puget Sound area would have its own problems to deal with, and obviously they would require assistance as well.
Thank you.
Okay, here's a slide focusing in on the Port of Portland just because of its significance in terms of the economy of Oregon. The port actually did take a little bit more detailed look at their facilities than some of the others. They have identified four of their main terminals, 2, 4, 5, and 6, as being having significant vulnerabilities. They are subject to this liquefaction. You'd have some lateral spreading where the port facilities would slide into either the Willamette or the Columbia River, and there would be significant damage to their buildings. This main Rivergate distribution area would suffer significant damage. When I was telling you about the horizontal movement and the 0.25 to 0.3 G, it turns out if you're on very soft soil that those ground motions can be even higher. And that's what would happen in this area around the Port of Portland. In terms of the airport, you've got their liquid fuel storage tanks are right near the Willamette River or the Columbia River over here on the west side. Those are also subject to liquefaction, would probably slide into the river, contaminating the water and not having the fuel available for the airplanes. There's a levee system along the Columbia River. The levee seems to be high enough unless there was major damage. And if there was major damage, then there is a potential for flooding from the Columbia River into the airport facility. The tower is had some strengthening, so it has some level of resistance to earthquakes, but there's a significant concern about differential settlement of the runways, which would probably preclude any use of fixed-wing aircraft there.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't that whole area be flooded by the storm surge? If there's a tsunami, it would just come right up the Columbia. The Columbia is affected by tides. The Willamette up to Willamette Falls is affected by tides. Certainly if there was a 50-foot storm surge, it would come all the way in and flood that whole area.
There would be some impact from that. I think that what I've heard, the estimates are just a matter of a few feet. Because we are 100 and some miles, river miles, yeah, from the coast, so there would be some dissipation of that major wave. You're right, it would come in there, but they're thinking that with the ground motions, those are the major vulnerability for the Portland area.
Okay.
Don't we have in that area, there's some big fuel farms, chemical farms. I'm not sure where they are.
This is the Willamette River where it comes into the Columbia, and the fuel farm is on the south side between the St. John's Bridge and the Fremont Bridge. And that's where the liquid fuel that services 95% of all the liquid fuel we use in Oregon comes through that particular site.
We also got the major natural gas lines and petroleum lines that come through there that are, I would assume if you have that serious liquefaction, those are probably going to be...
Yeah, without a significant investment in hardening and soil strengthening under those tanks, they would also basically slide into the river and contaminate the river.
The likelihood of having significant fires are pretty high there.
Possible. And without
more clock.
I think during the study, the energy portion estimated that we have maybe 72-hour supply of liquid fuel around the state without resupply from this area.
I was thinking more in terms of when you get those tanks bursting or those pipelines opening up, you just hope that nothing ignites it.
Yes. Could be very catastrophic. This is a slide just to depict the lifelines represented in the Portland area, and I just put this in here to acknowledge that we had some pretty good input from about 3 dozen of the local agencies, and they assessed their transportation facilities. In some cases, they're more resilient maybe than the state highways, so they proposed alternate routes around failed bridges on state highways. This busy slide here does include a number of lifelines in addition to the highways. It includes the water and sewer and energy lines. The red lines are energy lines. So the local agencies, in some cases, have done a lot of study and have good information about their lifelines and their resiliency. Getting back to the highway side, we are a little bit ahead of the other modes in terms of evaluation of what the situation is with bridges and landslides. And because we started earlier, we've done some simulation of what a 9.0 earthquake would do to our bridges. And you can see there's significant damage along 101. And this led us to conclude that all of the communities around 101 would be isolated, so none would have any highway connections that would be usable. Also, most of the routes from US 101 to I-5 would be unusable due to a few major bridge collapses and problems. And you can see why in emergency response, without some investment in terms of increasing resiliency, why FEMA was led to choose Redmond Airport and fixed wing into the valley, and understand that there would not be we'd not be able to reach people with supplies and rescue by highway because of the situation with the bridges and the landslides. So just how are we doing on bridge retrofit? Back in the mid-90s, we identified 1,155 bridges that needed retrofit. Since then, we started doing what we call phase one, which is just this life safety. And we've done some, 143, and also the ATIA program helped us quite a bit there. Get some more retrofitting done along with projects. So what we did while we're working at a bridge, it's fairly economical just to come in and put those restrainers on and keep the bridge from falling off. So we've been including that routinely. We really don't have enough budget to do the phase two, and we haven't been doing retrofit in a systematic, strategic way. So just if we happen to be working on a bridge somewhere, we include it because it's relatively economical. But we don't have any consistent, complete routes that have had this retrofitting. And that's where we need to head in the resilience study, is to be more strategic about what we're doing. You can see we have about 800 bridges left to retrofit. And at our current rate of progress over the last 20 years, we sort of projected that. If we continue as we are, it's way over 200 years before we get the retrofitting completed. And that would be only phase one. So we would need to do something different if we're really going to seriously become more resilient. Some people, when they've heard this sort of gloom and doom message, they wanted to know about particular bridges, especially in the Portland area, because of their strategic importance. So we did prepare some information that says what's going to happen, and you can see some notable things here. We have done phase one retrofitting of two of our most important strategic bridges, and that's I-5 Boone Bridge and the Markham Bridge. But most of the bridges, the major bridges, we have not retrofitted because of cost. You can see we're predicting that the Fremont approaches would collapse, Ross Island would not be usable. The old Selwood and Hawthorne bridges would collapse. Of course, we have the new TriMet structure now, which could be used, which is a great improvement because in most of the bridges in the Portland area would not be usable. And then for the Columbia River bridges, as I mentioned, we've got 101, the Longview Bridge, and the Interstate Bridge would not be usable after an event.
Mr. Edwards?
On that last chart, it said assessed performance. So if like I-5 Markham Bridge, moderate, does that mean that it will still be in service, but just big cracks that need to be looked at, or does that mean that it is out of service for a while until it can be assessed and some repair done to it?
We have an emergency response plan where we try to get to the bridges within 72 hours with a qualified structural engineer. We have a...
Even in this scenario where the bridges all over Oregon are just...
Yeah, it would be just... It'd be very difficult.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Very difficult to even get there.
Yeah.
And you have a sequence. So part of what you're going to hear from Paul is that, you know, if we don't do any preparation, it's 5 to 10 years probably, because you have to sequentially fix things in order to get to where you need to go to fix something else. So that's the issue that we have. But theoretically, we have plans that call for assessments relatively quickly. When we say moderate, what that means is we're not sure it could be fixed or cleared by an engineer within 72 hours. It's going to take longer. How much longer, we're not really sure. When we say extensive or collapse, that means that we believe the structure is going to need to be completely rebuilt and may not even be able to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things we learned from the resilience study, we do need to update the inventory. We need to do assessments, especially for the modes other than highway. Highway's done more assessment than the others. We need to develop a strategic mitigation policy and a retrofit plan that doesn't just focus on one mode, but fixes the mode that would best serve the population after a major event. And we need to identify the key links and, where necessary, start strategic retrofitting or increasing the resilience of those links. So at least we'll have a minimum level of access, say, to restore the economy and to rescue injured people. We have taken a look at our design and maintenance standards, and we've looked at a temporary bridge policy. We've identified not only sort of Bailey bridges that were used by the Army that are available, but in Oregon we have used railroad car structures that could be used to maybe temporarily restore traffic. And we're doing some research on retrofit activities. And then I'm going to finish off my part with just showing you that when we do have an opportunity to replace a bridge, we are definitely designing it to current standards. And even in the case of the Spencer Creek Bridge down there at Beverly Beach on US 101, was the first bridge where we took into account tsunami forces. So in addition to the heavy ground shaking from earthquakes, we estimated the force of a major tsunami wave coming in, and this bridge took that into account. Unfortunately, most of the other bridges were not designed with those kind of forces. And that is my part, and I was going to let Paul finish up the economic studies.
So where do we go from here? We've been putting some thought into that about how do we approach this. As you've heard Bruce talk about, we really think about this in kind of three different stages. Obviously, the first is the event itself, and how can we prevent the loss of life during the event itself. The second is the follow-up to that. How can we reestablish the transportation system, get people to hospitals, get food and shelter to people in that kind of short-term aftermath. The third thing, which I think doesn't get a lot of discussion or thought, and how it's different than a lot of other disasters that we face, is a long-term impact that's going to have to Oregon's economy. As Bruce mentioned, we're going to see impacts to Oregon's economy. That's not going to last a few months, a few weeks, even a few years. This is going to be a decade or longer impact Oregon's economy. What we did when we first started to tackle this problem is think back to the OTF3 bridge program and how we applied our economic model to understand the economic effects of not having bridges in place from a freight standpoint. We put the same model to use in trying to understand what was going to happen to the Oregon economy if these bridges Bruce just talked about were out of service for 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years. What would that look like to Oregon's economy? Our conclusion was you would see a net effect to Oregon's economy of $350 billion over a decade time. Which is obviously very significant. As you look towards some of the other recent events around the Pacific Rim, whether it's in Chile or in Japan, In both those cases, they've seen major impacts to the economy, but very different from us in that in Japan, they were much more prepared for this event than we are. And in Chile, they experience these events much more frequently than we do and thus have their weaker structure, weaker links have already been triggered, rebuilt to newer standards where we haven't had an event for hundreds of years. And so we're in a much worse situation than both those earthquake or event, and we're going to see a much longer impact to our economy than they're seeing in either one of those. So how do we strategically start looking at this? How do we identify the strategic lifelines and minimize those long-term economic events as well as the short-term things? And as we've talked about already, the upgrades to the bridges as well as the focus on landslide. So again, the three things that I've talked about, serviceability, life support, economic recovery, were the three factors we use to identify how do we prioritize routes and how do we approach this problem. We try to do it in kind of stages, bite-sized pieces, and we call them here tiers, a tier 1, 2, and 3 approach to solving this problem with the major state highways. Obviously, we can't do everything at once, but how do we focus strategically on a place to start and then branch out or build from there on other phases? So the first place we looked in our tier 1, as Bruce talked about, in securing kind of the beachhead type of approach to this is really Highway 97 in Central Oregon. That's where it's relatively easy to secure that route and build from there back towards the west. In this tier 1, we've actually divided it in half, again, trying to get to something that was affordable and serviceable, and we have a priority 1 and priority 2 within that tier 1, but our overall cost that we have just for tier 1 is $900 million. That $900 million addresses the retrofits that Bruce talked about, as well as the landslides on those routes. What it doesn't address is the health or the state of those bridges currently. Many of those bridges have many other problems that need to be addressed, and it may not make sense to go do seismic retrofit on a bridge that needs to be replaced or have major upgrades to them. So part of the work we're currently doing is further understanding kind of what other work needs to be done to that bridge so when we get to it, we can make the best investment possible, whether that means replacement or whether that means other upgrades structurally to that bridge before we make an investment seismically in that structure. So here's the route, or the tier 2 and 3, which would be another $900 million to secure those routes. Turning back to the economic model, if you look at that $350 billion impact, this is our assessment of what that impact is going to look like. And that, if you look at this, it's kind of a heat map. And the heat map is both from a highway standpoint and a regional standpoint. So the darker the red color on the route, those are the routes that are going to be closed longer. And the dark red ones on here we've assumed are going to be closed for 5 years. And those dark red areas that are shaded are the areas affected by those routes being closed. And those areas are going to be not accessible by highway for up to 5 years in this event based on where we are currently. If we make the investment in just that tier one, you can see the kind of the cooling of that heat map. And our model says a reduction of about 10% of the economic impact, or $35 billion, just by that investment, just in transportation, just on that on those tier one and those tier one routes. In the same way, if you invest in the next two tiers, we see an overall reduction of that $355 by $84 billion, or about 25% reduction, and you see a significant kind of cooling of that heat map or the impacts that we're going to see economically long-term to those parts of Oregon. The thing that was most interesting to me in thinking about this, in relative to Oregon's economy, many of our natural resource-based industries are going to stay in Oregon. They're going to struggle through this, but they're going to return because of their dependence on what we have here in Oregon. Many of the industries that are here because of Oregon's quality of life, not because of natural resource base, they're going to need to keep functioning as a business. Many of those are going to leave the state. And we're going to have to re-recruit those businesses back to the state. Many of the high-tech firms, many of the large industries that we now depend on from an economic standpoint in the state are going to struggle to just conduct their business, get their employees to work, and have their employees enjoy the quality of life we do now in Oregon. Many of those are going to migrate out of the state, and we're going to have to re-compete to get them back to the state. That's the significant piece from that long-term economic impact that we're going to see, likely not just for a decade, but long-term, maybe as much as a generation for Oregon. So one of the things that our commission has done is tried with the limited resources, thinking back to my previous presentation of where we are resource-wise, when we do have those opportunities, how can we start to get ready? We've identified a strategy now. How can we start putting some investment into being ready for maybe a larger investment in the bridges? And so they've identified $2.5 million to help us do more detailed scoping of 217 of the bridges that are in Tier 1 so we can understand truer costs. The estimates that I shared with you are kind of what we call desk scoping things. We just pulled out the plans and made some assumptions and some estimates. Well, let's get some more detail into those. And then in the 22 bridges, let's actually do designs and actually learn and compare those desk scoping estimates to our designs and better calibrate those so we can get good true estimates of what this is going to cost us. And then do some of the work that I mentioned before. What else needs to be done to those bridges besides the seismic upgrade to make those bridges serviceable long term? Looking, along the West Coast, we've been very relatively fortunate in Oregon in the amount of earthquakes that we've had. California has obviously experienced more, and it's been kind of a wake-up call to them and the investment that they need to make in their bridges, and they've obviously made a very significant investment in seismically retrofitting their bridges. Washington has also made a much more investment than we have. But as Bruce pointed out, just for a couple of reasons. One is the amount of resources that we have available to make the upgrades, but also it's been relatively recent that we've understood the seismic impacts on bridges and just what this is going to mean to Oregon. And so all those things have led to us kind of being behind the other states on the West Coast in addressing this. But our major point is we need to start. It's a major undertaking. It's a major investment, but we need to start. We need to start somewhere. Here's a just a graphic showing the kind of the rate of the return. So if you sum up all the three tiers I just talked about, the $1.8 billion. And we see a long-term benefit to the economy of $84 billion. Do the math, and it's roughly a 50-to-1 benefit for the program. But again, we need to start. If we don't get started, we're never going to realize any of these benefits. And that's really our message is to start making that investment.
Great.
Good.
Question?
Yeah. Sure. What's the guesstimate of the timeline at which we could face the big one? Is it it's between now and 50 years from now, or now and 2,000 years?
The Senator Edwards, the most recent estimates from Dogami. It's still a low probability event. I don't remember the exact figure, but I think it was a 30% chance in the next 50 years, something in that area. So that's still less than a 1% chance of it occurring in any given year, which makes it really difficult for people to focus on. But in the world of earthquakes, that's a relatively high probability.
And that one, there's some history, and I forget it. The Cascadia event happens every 500 years?
Depending on what part of the fault, the 300 to 500-year recurrence, roughly.
And the last one was?
January 26th of 1700.
Yeah. 300 years ago.
Yeah.
I know. Really reshuffled the coastline.
Other questions?
Yeah. Well, really quickly, I know we got to get out of here, but so with this, the amount of planning and study that's gone into this, has there been, other than to the legislature and the executive branch agencies, it and the occasional newspaper report, it doesn't seem to me that the general public knows about it a lot, but when I was looking at the map of different affected areas, whether it's airports or bridges or key transportation lines, I mean there are a lot of companies in Oregon, both small and really large major companies that have significant investments and livelihoods at stake, and it just seems that if they had this information, would be perhaps a little bit more interested in doing something about the problem if they knew how vulnerable they are. So I'm just wondering, is there any, what's the next step in terms of outreach and public education.
Senator Edwards, the process of developing the Oregon Resilience Plan actually included a private sector business group. So that included the utilities, who are also critical infrastructure, but also just large employers, manufacturers. Intel was a big player in that, and actually it's an Intel staffer who represents private business on our task force. So we engaged them as much as we could, and some of the recommendations in the original in the resilience plan report are specifically focused on private sector in terms of better awareness and business continuity preparedness. Within our current task force, that's part of the picture. You know, some of our recommendations, and actually part of our direct charge from Senate Bill 33 last year, was to make recommendations on not just the engineering, you know, construction, whether it's new construction or retrofit, but also education of the public, businesses, as well as more professional training for emergency managers, responders, decision makers. So we are engaging in that. There's a fair bit of public outreach that goes on a daily basis from, you know, from my agency and many others. It's just, you know, we're all human. It's mm-hmm. and yet, saying you don't fix the roof when the sun's shining. It's really difficult to keep that on people's radar screen, but it is one of our items, and that's ongoing.
Yeah, and the reason I bring it up is because, obviously, I mean, planning for this type of stuff is good, this is the good, responsible thing to do, but this is ultimately going to be a decision that's going to be under the pressure of politics in coming legislative sessions, and to have, and it's great that Intel's involved, major player in Oregon's economy, but I'm wondering, okay, does the Klamath Falls Chamber of Commerce and the Medford Chamber of Commerce and, you know, do those type of entities that are in different locations around the state understand what their local vulnerabilities are to their economy, to transportation links in and out of their communities, and what the impacts would be, so that we don't just have Intel and Nike in the legislature saying we support this package, but so there are, you know, local, you know, dispersed communities really understanding what the vulnerabilities are. So anyway, I guess it doesn't require a response.
No, okay. Well, okay, I won't.
Anything else? Great report. Not exactly a happy report. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
For the invitation.
Okay, our last item for today is just an update on the landscape work group, and I'm just asking Senator Thompson.
Yeah. And Bill Cross.
Bill's here somewhere. See him.
Oh, I think he gave up.
He gave up and ducked out?
Well, I don't blame him. Maybe he might have another.
Bill's right there.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah. Bill's here.
I'll join him up front.
You don't have to. You can do it from there.
Okay. Yo, Bill.
It's your show, Chuck.
Okay. I'll just... Unless, Bill, you want to... Bill's been at our work groups. We had three work groups. A landscape contractor... Basically, was the participants included the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, the Landscape Contractors Board, the LCB, and reps from the industry who supported the Senate Bill 557 in the 2013 session. I believe we've had three meetings, and kind of the first couple of meetings we went over the history, what was the process that got them to kind of where they were. Major discussions on basically all the issues, and I think kind of the core of the issue was, it gets down to training, the amount of time, amount of classes that they have to take. That seems to be a contentious issue. Besides being licensed and demonstrating proof of bonding liability and workers' comp,
insurance, the landscaping business, should there be a requirement that they employ a landscape professional who is also licensed based on their ability to demonstrate that they've taken the classes and pass a test, and there's some contention in that. So at this point, I think we've discussed all the issues. There's not total agreement. You know, I mean, that was a pretty contentious bill that we had, and that's why we formed the task force. But at this time, I mean, we're planning on having another meeting today, but basically the Landscape Contract Association wants a little more time at this point, because we've done all the discussing. So I think we're at that point. They're going to survey their membership on the issues that we discussed and kind of get a feeling for the legislation that they're going to bring to us in the next session. So, you know, that was kind of my first task force that you guys stuck me on. I mean chair. That's what I mean. It's been a great demonstration of bringing two sides together that don't really agree on a couple of details, but I think on the whole they kind of agree in concept. So I think we'll through this group we'll have a better piece of legislation that I think our committee maybe can get to a yes to support instead of
last time. We'll have a kumbaya.
Well, I don't know
legislation.
About that. Yeah, yeah. But I think we're getting there. Yeah, okay. Pretty positive.
Any questions, Chuck? Bill, do you want to add anything?
Good report.
Okay.
Well, great. You wrote it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking it on.
You bet.
Anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.